No Sleep Podcast. You're listening to the No Sleep Podcast. Thanks for making us part of your horror soundtrack. I'm your host, David Cummings. We are delighted to welcome you to the 25th season of the No Sleep Podcast. In traditional folklore, 25 is the silver anniversary. For us, that doesn't mean jewelry. It means we finally have enough silver to forge the bullets. And with our new season, we're going to focus on something that might seem rather obvious for an audio production like ours. The focus is on the sounds of horror. Audio nightmares. Or, as I'm calling it, the frequency of fear. From the very first episode of this podcast, our focus has been to adapt stories to audio by combining the words with music, sound effects, and audio sound design to enhance the horror. And I'm sure we all realize how much terror can come from sounds. Those haunting footsteps heard in an empty attic above. The creak of a door opening when you're alone in the house. The whisper that floats past your ear just as you're falling into sleep. The things we hear can be as devastatingly terrifying as the things we see. And we want to bring you auditory terror that will stick with you long after the stories are over. So make sure you have some good headphones, settle into a quiet space, and close your eyes. Let the sounds transport you into a world where horror surrounds you and embraces you. It's season 25, and it's time to listen up. Now, brace yourself for the frequency of fear. In our first tale, we meet Sarah and Marcus, two friends out for a hike, and they've split up to see which path to the scenic outlook is the best. But in this tale, shared with us by author Cosmic Dread, Sarah is waiting for Marcus to show up. His lateness is making her worried, and all she really wants is to hear the sound of his voice. This tale has been produced by Jeff Clement and features performances by Aaron Lillis and Jeff Clement. So listen for the sounds of the forest. Is that a voice, or is it the breathing woods?
"20 minutes of calling out Marcus's name was when I stopped pretending everything was all right. The plan was simple. Split at the fork, meet at the overlook in 45 minutes. Marcus goes high, I go low, and we'd argue over whose view was better, like we'd been doing since our college backpacking trips. Except Marcus was 30 minutes overdue, and my phone was dead, and the forest had gone quiet in a way that gave me the creeps. I doubled back to the junction, hiked up onto the high trail, and called his name, my throat already hurting. The red markers were there on the trees in the same pattern the trail map said they'd be. Yet something wasn't quite right. The spacing of them, maybe? And this was the maddening thing. They seemed to shift when I wasn't looking directly at them. Come on, Sarah, pull yourself together. I stopped, puffing harder than the incline really required. I was 42 and out of shape, and I felt every one of those years. Marcus was probably at the parking lot already, checking his watch, wondering what on earth was taking me so long. Except he wouldn't do that. He would wait. Marcus always waited. The smell seemed to coalesce out of the air. Rotten sweetness, heavy enough to choke on. Something must have died in the underbrush and stayed there, rotting. I pulled my sleeve across my nose. My eyes were burning. Must be a deer, maybe a bear kill. The ranger that morning had promised us the black bears around here usually avoided people. Usually. I went on. My boots grated on rock and bare roots. Above me, the branches tangled like fingers knitting together. I looked away, but the image had already rooted itself in my mind. Cut it out. You're spooked because Marcus is late and you've been watching too much true crime TV. That's when I heard the breathing. Deep, rhythmic, deliberate. I froze in my tracks. That wasn't me. I'd stopped, wasn't even breathing that hard for a second there. This was off to my left, off the trail, in the woods where no one had any business being. In, out, in, out. Slow, patient, like something asleep that wasn't quite asleep. Marcus? My voice came out wrong, too small, too scared. The breathing didn't change, didn't stop, didn't quicken. Just kept on, steady as a metronome. Not very human. I knew it and hated myself for knowing it. My hand fumbled for the bear spray holstered on my belt. What had the ranger said? Make noise, make yourself big, back away slowly. But this wasn't a bear. Bears didn't breathe like that. All measured and intentional, all aware. I stepped back once. My gaze tore at the woods, darkening. Wait, darkening? I glanced at my watch. 3:47 p.m., hours of daylight left. Yet the shadows under the trees had deepened to almost solidity, pooling in the low spots like oil. Movement at the corner of my eye. I whipped my head around. Nothing. Trees and underbrush and that infernal breathing. But the second I turned back, I saw it again in my periphery. Something large, pacing me as I backed down the trail. I have bear spray. My voice shook. I hated that, but couldn't stop it. I'm leaving. Right now. I don't want any trouble. The breathing ceased. Silence hit like a punch. Worse in a way than the breathing. My entire body screamed at me, that old reptile brain that warns you when something's watching you, when you've become the prey. All the horror movie cliches crashed through my head. Don't turn around. Don't run. Don't. I stopped suddenly, seeing something off the trail. Bones were scattered over a flat rock. Small bones. Finger bones, my brain added unhelpfully, uselessly. Spirally arranged. And in the center, one tooth. Too big for a human. Not quite right for an animal either. Yellow and serrated, curved like a fish hook, and it gleamed wetly in the failing light as though it had just been torn from someone's mouth. My stomach lurched. I stumbled backward, almost fell, and that was when I heard Marcus behind me.
Sarah! Where are you?
Relief hit so hard, I almost cried. Marcus! Oh, thank God! I'm right here! I'm
in... Sarah!
His voice was in front now. That wasn't... Sound doesn't do that.
Sarah! I can't find the trail!
Behind me. No, to the left. No.
Sarah, where are you?
The voices repeated. Marcus voices superimposed over Marcus voices, shouting my name in every direction. Some were a little off kilter, some with the cadence just half a beat off. I clamped my hands over my ears, but I could still hear them. All those almost Marcus voices echoing through the trees. I ran. Red markers flashed by like warnings of peril. Breath came in rags, heart thudding against my ribs. A great something crashed through the underbrush, behind, ahead, beside, keeping pace while I stumbled and flailed like wounded prey. The breathing started again. All around this time, the whole forest inhaled and exhaled, and the trees swayed in rhythm with invisible lungs. In, out, waiting. Timeless, patient. I dropped into a clearing I didn't recognize. The overlook should have been there. I could have sworn it, but what I'd stumbled upon was a ring of exposed earth circled by gnarled oaks whose roots writhed above ground like snakes turned to stone. Marcus stood in the middle. Marcus! I ran to him, crying. Something's out here! Something's really wrong with this place! We have to get up! He turned around. It was Marcus, his face, his gear, his concerned look. But his eyes were wrong. Pupils expanded so wide they took up the whole iris, and when he smiled, there were too many teeth. Just a bit. Just enough to make a difference.
You found me.
His voice was okay, except that it was happening behind him. A half-second delay, like watching a movie with bad audio sync. I backed away. Bear spray between us. What are you?
I'm Marcus.
It took a step forward.
Don't you recognize your old friend?
Where's the real Marcus? The thing wearing Marcus's skin cocked its head, considering.
Does it matter? You called him. I answer.
The breathing enveloped us now, emanating from the trees. I finally grasped. From all the trees. Every shadow, every grass blade, all of it alive and waiting and hungry. The red markers. You changed them. You've been leading me here. Not Marcus smiled wider.
So easy to turn back. One marker moved when you weren't looking. One path that doubles back. Humans never notice. You trust your map. More than your senses.
My finger was on the trigger of the spray. Let me go.
But you wanted to find your friend.
It gestured to the edge of the clearing. Marcus was on the ground in the ferns, not moving. Pack torn open, things spilling out. I couldn't see his face. Didn't need to. The angle of his neck told me everything. What did you do?
Nothing.
The way it was said made me believe.
He fell. Happens all the time. So easy to lose the trail. So easy to take one wrong step.
It moved a step nearer. Its shadow didn't match its body, going too long, spreading like roots.
But you're different. You kept calling.
Your voice led us. Your worry brought you here.
The breathing was now louder. The trees seemed closer. Clearing was shrinking, roots inching inwards, and shadows reached out with finger-like branches. I sprayed. orange mist splattered not Marcus right in the face. It didn't blink, just stood there, wearing my friend's face while the chemicals dripped off like water on stone. Then it laughed, like wind through an empty skull, hollow and never ending. I ran. I didn't know where, just away. Away from the clearing, the thing, Marcus's broken body. The woods closed around me. Branches whipped my face. Roots stretched out to snag at my feet. The breathing came next. That slow in, out, and beneath it I could hear things forcing their way through the undergrowth. More than one, closing in. I crashed through the underbrush and suddenly there, the trail. Red markers pointing the way down. I didn't ask questions, didn't ask myself why it was here. I just ran, following the markers down and down and down. The parking lot materialized like an oasis. My car, Marcus's truck parked beside it. My hands shook so badly I almost dropped the keys. The engine roared to life on the first turn of the key. I backed it up in a shower of gravel, not noticing where I was going, just away to get to town, get help, bring back Marcus. In the rearview mirror at the tree line, I saw myself. Same clothes, same face, same look of utter terror, standing perfectly still, watching the car drive away. I drove. I knew. Gut level, bone deep. That wasn't my reflection. That was the woods trying on my skin for size. The ranger station was vacant. A back in 30 minutes sign leaned crookedly on the door. I sat there, engine running, hands tight on the wheel, waiting. My watch said 4:15 p.m. Impossible. I'd been in the woods for hours. It should be dark. Unless... I checked my phone for the date. Same day. My gaze fell to the road behind, back to the parking lot, the trailhead, the breathing woods. I could see them from here, a dark blot on the horizon, waiting, eternal. I thought of Marcus, of returning. Then I looked down at my hands, dirt under my fingernails that hadn't been there this morning. I breathed in. Under my fear, sweat, and the car air freshener, something else. Faint, but there. Rot. Sweet and heavy. From my clothes, my hair, my skin. In. Out. In. Out. I drove. Away from the station, away from the woods, away from what was left of Marcus in that clearing. Drove until I hit the highway, then drove on, checking the mirror for anything following. But the road stayed empty. The only breath was mine. Hours later, I stopped. A gas station several towns over. I looked at myself in the mirror of the bathroom. My face, my eyes, everything exactly as it should be. Standing behind me in the reflection, just visible at the edge of the mirror, something tall and wrong stood watching. I didn't turn around, didn't scream, didn't run. I knew because deep down in a place I didn't care to look too closely at, no matter how far I drove, I had taken too many wrong turns. The woods had my scent now, and the woods were patient. I exited the bathroom, got in my car, and merged onto the highway. In the back seat, barely visible in the rear view, something stirred in the darkness. Something that breathed in perfect harmony with my tires humming on asphalt. In. Out. In. Thank you.
the sonic sounds of sponsors bring you all this content for free. Join our sleepless universe for even more ad-free audio nightmares.
We're excited to kick off our new season with our newest sponsor, Vinted. Listen, I'm no fashionista, but even my closet is full of clothes I'll likely never wear again. So I could pitch them or I could list them on Vinted. Vinted is a secondhand marketplace app that makes it easy for everyday sellers, people like you and me, to sell pre-loved fashion and earn some extra money. I've had to move a few times in the past few years, and let me tell you, moving the same ton of clothes from one place to another, all while knowing I don't wear most of them, is such a waste of time. With Vinted, I can turn those clothes into money. Listing your clothes on Vinted is a super easy process. And get this, there are no selling fees, so you keep everything you earn. And the Vinted app is free to download, so turning your clothes into cash is a no-brainer. Listing on Vinted is simple. Snap a few photos, add a quick description, and set your price. Once the items sell, Vinted creates the prepaid shipping label for you. The buyers pay for shipping, and you keep 100% of what you earn. Ready to clean out your closet and make some extra money? Download the Vinted app for free and start listing. With no seller fees, you keep every dollar you earn. Thanks for your support, Vinted, and for helping us have a cleaner closet and a fuller wallet.
Listen closely as we return to the frequency of fear.
They say if you lose one of your senses, the others can become more acute. And if you're like Ellie, her diminished vision means she relies on her other senses to get around. She's also helped by her dear friend Lily, who helps guide her through the world. But in this tale, shared with us by author B.T. Stanley, Ellie is taken on an unexpected car trip. And no, Ellie isn't the one driving. This tale has been produced by Jeff Clement and features performances by Ash Millman, Erica Sanderson, Danielle McRae, David Alt, James Cleveland, Jake Benson, and Andy Cresswell. So it's tough enough on the roads with all your senses. Even more horrifying is finding yourself driving blind.
Alien. Beside me, Lily laughs.
Took your bloodhound nose long enough to figure that out.
I grin and sink back into the worn cloth seat, still faintly smelling of takeaway chips and car freshener. After all the perfume you sprayed at the boot sample counter, even I'm not that quick. Lily signals to overtake, the indicator ticking in time with the rhythm I drum against my knee.
Don't know about you, but Brighton's drained me. You still fancy that upmarket place, or should we just grab a takeaway and crash at mine?
Takeaway works. Where are we now?
Outskirts of New Haven. Oh, they don't take cards, we'll have to get some cash out.
I nod, listening to the world blur past. The rush of cars, a distant siren, and the uneven growl of Lily's battered old Ford Fiesta. The sort of car every student buys cheap and regrets later. At least we lost that weirdo at the mall.
Yeah. Guy must have thought we were wearing his clothes, the way he kept looking us up and down.
The engine lets out a loud, throaty grumble, as if backing her up.
God, I swear that backstreet garage sold me the mother of all bangers. Piece of crap's gonna conk out at this rate.
But it was cheap, I say, slipping into a half-hearted impression of her mum. Then I grin. Knowing your luck, it's probably a cut and shut. She snorts and pulls up at the curb.
Got a cash point. Be back in a sec, Ellie.
Leaving the engine running, she climbs out and slams the door. I wince. She's got a thing about that. Car doors, flat doors, and especially the ones on campus. I stare out the window. I can tell the sky's grey. That's about it. Evening creeping in, traffic rumbling past, the blurry shapes of the car's interior swimming in the dim light. Lily is more than a bestie. I've got Leber's congenital amaurosis, a fancy way of saying I can't see much. Just light and shadow, nothing useful. Lily and I grew up on the same street, so she got used to me without the awkwardness or nerves most people show. We went through college together, and now uni. She makes things easier, explaining what's around us, helping me get comfortable in new places until they feel familiar. She's my main guide. I can't stand white canes, and guide dogs never really click with me. My thoughts drift to what I'll order from the Chinese. Egg fried rice with plenty of extra egg and... The driver's door opens, the seat creaks, and it closes softly this time before we pull away. That was quick. Silence. Lily rarely talks while she's navigating, so I give it a few seconds. The car reaches the end of the road, then takes a sharp left. That was quick. I try again. Still nothing. I'm about to ask what's up when a deafening crash erupts back along the road. A shattering, grinding roar that rattles through the car and makes my chest seize. What the hell was that? I twist in my seat, even though I can't see a thing. Lily says nothing. The car just accelerates. Lily, what happened? Still nothing. Only the growl of the engine rising in pitch. Maybe she'd seen something earlier? Something that scared her? She could be on autopilot or deep-rooted shock, just focused on getting us out of here. Lil. Normally she'd react when I called her that, but not this time. A strange smell invades my nostrils. Boot polish. That doesn't make sense. The scent is literally alien this time. Lily, like me, is a tracksuit and trainers girl. Not the type to wear boots, let alone polish them. A knot tightens in my chest. Lily? This time it comes out more like a question. The car jerks hard right, tyres squealing, and anxiety hardens into fear. Slowly, and I'll admit, reluctantly, I reach out to touch her arm and get a jolt of pure terror. There's no one there. For a moment, I try to rationalise it. Maybe she'd leaned the seat back for some reason. I reach out, feeling the air where she should have been. Nothing. My hand brushes the headrest, then the backrest. Empty. I drop my hand to the cushion beneath, half expecting warmth or movement, but there is only cold fabric and a faint draft, which makes no sense because the air conditioning is off. Lily! I fumble over the driver's seats, then reach into the back seats. Oh, I don't know why. Nothing. I am alone in a car that is driving itself, calm as you like, as if this were just another Sunday drive. Had the handbrake slipped? I dismiss that idea almost instantly. Maybe a tow truck had hooked us? But surely I'd have heard the chains, the clunk, something. The car hooks a left, then overtakes something, the indicator ticking softly near the wheel. The wheel? I reach out and actually feel it turning beneath my hand. The same cold air hits me again, sharp and tingling, like pins and needles running through my skin, as if something invisible has brushed past. The car brakes hard. Its horn blares as it swerves around what I guess is an oncoming vehicle, judging by the shouted curses and the retaliatory horn blast as we shoot by. Then it straightens out, changes up a gear, and takes another turn. A single sharp beep sounds from the built-in sat-nav. I recognise it instantly. The warning for a speed camera. The car eases down, a slow, obedient crawl, almost human in the way it lingers, then shoots forward again, engine whining as if proud of itself. I try to breathe, to think. My heart is racing faster than the car itself. If it stops, I'll scream the place down, but there is no sign of that happening. Jumping out crosses my mind, but we'd have to be doing 50. Best case, I'd shatter every bone in my body. Worst, I wouldn't get up again. There has to be something, anything I can do. My phone. I yank open my hoodie pocket and press the side button. Siri, call emergency services. Nothing. Siri, turn off voiceover. I shout, thinking the screen reader is frozen. Still nothing. The phone isn't responding. I hold it up, waiting for the glow of the screen. Nothing. No light, no sound. It is frigid, the casing radiating the same tingling cold I'd felt near the wheel. Shit. Another desperate theory hits me. Maybe it's some kind of hack. I dismiss that idea too. This isn't a self-driving car. This thing is worth $5,000 on a good day, not one of those $100,000 robo-taxis. A new dread settles over me. I don't have any money. Oh, God. What if they don't want money at all? Cold sweat breaks across my skin as the unnatural chill continues to seep through the car. It isn't just fear. It is that deep, suffocating dread that crawls inside and won't let go. My breathing hitches. I can almost feel eyes on me, close enough to touch. I scream. I didn't plan to. It just tore out of me, raw and jagged, bouncing off the windows and back into my ears. My throat burns. My chest locks. But the sound does nothing. Whoever, or whatever, is driving doesn't react. Not at first. The air grows colder. So cold it feels like my lungs might freeze from the inside. Then, suddenly, the wipers flick on. A soft hum. The gentle sweep of water against the glass. For a heartbeat, it's almost soothing. Like the car is trying to calm me down. The thought barely forms before the radio crackles to life. A classical station, violins weaving through static, oddly tender, drifting through my panic like a lullaby I didn't ask for. The car slows, and a synthetic female voice breaks the silence.
Your destination is on the left, Green Dragon Pub.
The car rolls to a stop. I don't wait. My thumb slams into the seatbelt release. Somehow, through the whole insane ride, I've still been wearing it. It doesn't move. The button is locked solid. I twist, try to squirm free. I'm slim, so I have this ridiculous idea I can slide out from under it. The belt tightens suddenly. Not cruelly, just firmly. The engine cuts out, sputters back to life, then dies again. Almost as if the car is trying to make up its mind. My hand shoots to the door handle, yanking hard. Nothing. Locked. Feel for the door pin, one of those old ones you can pull up manually. But it's slick, like it's been greased. Not me or Lily's doing. We always keep wet wipes in the car for when we eat. Voices echo nearby. Close. I twist the window crank, desperate to get it open. It won't budge. Wedged solid. Help me! I hammer the glass with the side of my fist. The engine roars in response, a warning snarl. Through the panic, I finally register the voices outside. Male, harsh, jeering. I've heard that tone before. Drunk hooligans about to smash something. Or someone. My gut feeling is confirmed a moment later.
What's up, love? Fancy joining the party?
A different bolt of fear flares in my chest. The car is terrifying, but they are worse. Another voice shouts, closer with each word.
Grab the bitch. Use her as a hostage.
Then a third, cold and focused.
Get the keys. That Ford's going with us.
The words slice through the haze, their meaning settling over me like a weight, pressing the air from my lungs. Then the car's alarm erupts into life. A deafening shriek that makes me flinch. Over the din, I catch more shouting and the sharp crack of glass breaking somewhere nearby. The door handle rattles, hard, quick, like someone testing it from the outside. For a split second, I think it will give, that they're about to get in. The car lurches backwards, then surges forwards again. A heavy thud, followed by a yell of agony. I get the awful impression someone has just had their foot crushed. I press myself back in the seat, heartbeat hammering. Then we are moving again. Fast. The tyres scream as we tear around the next bend. The car races on, speed building with every breath, the engine's roar swelling until it fills my world, louder, deeper, all-consuming. I can feel it thrumming through the seat, the floor, my bones, like the whole car has become a living thing dragging me with it. I slump back, heart pounding, but a strange calm begins to settle over me. Maybe this is it. Maybe I am going to die, and there is nothing I can do to stop it. All I can do is breathe, try to hold on to my dignity, and pray it will be quick. The alarm cuts out. The car slows. Engines pass us. Ordinary cars, ordinary lives. And then a siren wails nearby, closer this time. I can tell the difference in pitch. This one is police. Hope surges through me and I wave frantically, shouting even though I know they can't hear. The siren roars by, heading back the way we'd come. I slump down, a sound halfway between a sob and a groan escaping me. I try my phone again. Nothing. Around me, the scent of boot polish thickens until it fills my lungs. Tears warm my cheeks. The classical music returns, louder now, steady, mournful. The car slows. The familiar double beat tick starts up, the sound the hazards make when Lily hits the red triangle on the dash. The rhythm is steady, on, off, then on again. I hesitate, a strange thought forming. It's as if it's trying to tell me something. Hello? Is that you? No answer, just the soft hum of the engine. Then the horn gives a single, gentle bip. Almost like a reply. My thoughts start to race. The bang back at the cash point. But something happened there. Then the stop at the pub, the shouting, the drunks. Maybe it had taken me there because it thought a pub meant safety. But then it must have realised whatever was happening there wasn't safe at all. The police heading that way proved it. So, if it isn't trying to hurt me, what is it doing? Where is it taking me now? I swallow hard. Okay. If you can understand me, bip once for yes, twice for no. All right? My throat tightens. I am negotiating with a car, and the car has answered. Are you going to hurt me? For the first time since this nightmare began, I let out a shaky breath that almost turns into a laugh. We glide around a roundabout, smooth and deliberate, then take a gentle left. Another turn, sharper this time. A brief burst of speed, then a slow roll onto gravel. A final curve, then a calm, steady stop. The music fades. The engine goes quiet. A soft click. The handbrake. Silence. Hello? A faint jingle of metal. Then something cold drops into my lap. I reach out, trembling. My fingers brush the shape of keys. The driver's door opens, then closes softly. And I am alone. For a few seconds, there is nothing. No sound, no movement, just the hollow quiet of an empty car. The ringtone hits like an explosion, slicing through the silence and sending a shock right through me. I snatch it up, hands shaking. The unnatural chill is gone, replaced by the familiar slight warmth of a working battery.
Incoming call. Lily, mobile.
I double tap with two fingers to answer. Lily? Oh my God, where are you?
At the cash point. Ellie, I feel so sick. A lorry mounted the curb. The driver passed out at the wheel. He was heading straight for your side. God, if the car hadn't taken off like that, it would have hit you. No one's hurt, thank God, but oh, that was too bloody close.
My mouth goes dry.
The tracker's working now. I can see you at New Haven Police Station. Who drove you there?
I look out through the windscreen. The faint glow of blue lights reflects off the glass. They've gone.
Who's gone?
Whoever drove me. She doesn't answer for a few seconds.
All right, listen. One of the coppers here is giving me a lift over. I'll ring ahead. Get someone to come out to you, okay?
Okay. My voice steadies for the first time all night. Thanks, Lil. The line clicks off. A few minutes later, footsteps crunch on the gravel. A man's voice, steady, local accent.
You all right, love?
I nod. Yeah, I think so. The door's locked. He reaches over and gives the handle a tug. To my surprise, it opens without a hitch. The night air hits me, cool, clean, and painfully normal.
Well, you've been on an adventure tonight. Bet you could use a cover.
He crouches beside the open door, torchlight sweeping across the dashboard.
Recognise this car, I do. Used to belong to a local girl. Royal Marines medic. Lovely kid. Bit obsessed with polishing her boots till you could see her face in them.
The smell of boot polish lingers faintly in the air, unmistakable. What happened to her?
Killed in action, they said. Though one of her squad swore she didn't die at all. Reckon she got pulled into some MI6 black ops thing. If you believe that sort of nonsense.
I tried to smile. Yeah, maybe. He stands and pats the roof.
Well, whoever was driving tonight's a hero. Word just came through. Car matching this one stopped a few drunk chancers up at the Green Dragon. Ran over one bloke's foot and slowed the rest just long enough for us to get there.
I didn't see anyone. He nods.
You didn't happen to speak to them, did you?
I shake my head. Didn't hear a thing. He sighs, a deep, weary sound that speaks of long hours and endless paperwork.
It's ironic, you know. That Green Dragon pub is where she grew up. Run by her mum, no less. Makes you wonder, doesn't it?
The officers went through the CCTV from the car park, but the footage had glitched out completely. No driver, no movement, nothing at all. I didn't tell them the truth about the car driving itself or the empty seat beside me. They were content to believe it was just a good Samaritan who didn't want to be found. Later, Lily arrived and hugged me so hard it nearly knocked the breath out of me, whispering over and over how glad she was that I'd made it. When I told her everything, I'm not sure she believed me, though she tried to. She just kept saying it didn't matter, that I was safe, and that whoever or whatever helped me had done a good thing. I still don't know what it was. A ghost? Some kind of black ops tech that slipped through the cracks? Maybe both. When Lily dropped me off that night, I stood outside my flat for a moment, breathing in the cool air. And just as she drove away, I swear I heard it. The faint, gentle bip from somewhere down the street. Like the car letting me know I was home.
Of sponsors bring you all this content for free. Join our sleepless universe for even more ad-free audio nightmares.
If ye hath eyes to see, you'll know August is coming to an end. That means back to school and back to a regular routine. So is your closet, perhaps a little lighter now, ready for it? Well, I can't think of a better place to start than Quince. I've been rocking my Quince beach shorts and merino wool polo all summer. And Kelly loves summer shorts weather, but when things cool down a bit, she'll be sliding into her Bella Stretch straight jeans. Denim super stretch made with organic cotton for a stylish fit. She loves how they feel and how they look. And the prices we pay? Compared to comparable brands, we paid almost 80% less. If you're still wearing the same threadbare tees and pants, Quince makes it easy to upgrade. They have premium denim and tailored chinos from just $60 with the kind of perfect fit, structure, and high-quality fabrics you'd expect from a luxury designer brand. And it's not just clothing. Quince has been my go-to for everything from hotel-quality bedding and bath essentials to premium cookware and travel must-haves. Upgrade your everyday. Download the Quince app for app-exclusive offers or go to quince.com/nosleep. Get free shipping on your order and 365-day returns. Now available in Canada and the UK too. That's quince.com/nosleep.
Listen closely as we return to the frequency of fear.
When it comes to feats of physical endurance, there are few things as impressive as reaching the summit of Mount Everest. Calling it a harrowing and exhausting effort would be a gross understatement. That's why there are many who simply don't survive their attempt. But in this tale, shared with us by author E. Gallagher, we meet a woman who reached the top of the world. But now she hopes she can find a friend who got lost on the way down. This tale has been produced by Jesse Cornett and features performances by Marie Westbrook, Jake Benson, and Danielle McRae. So if you find yourself high upon the mountain, get down as quickly as you can. There's a reason the slopes above 8,000 meters are called the Death Zone.
Wind screams as it barrels down the mountain. Mad gusts punch into our tent, ripping at the trembling nylon seams. The fabric pulls taut in a frenzied series of staccato pops. I breathe in. My oxygen bottle whines. I breathe out. The air escapes with a hiss. At 1:47 p.m. today, I summited Mount Everest. I escape into the memory, retracing my final steps up to the roof of the world. I reached for the summit marker, reverently brushing a gloved hand over ribbons of multicolored prayer flags. I whooped as Leah approached and she hugged me fiercely, blinking back tears. We clung to each other, taking in the ethereal panorama of the Himalayan mountains. It was a moment of brilliant, unbridled euphoria. Mick starts coughing again. His body quakes pitifully as a harsh, dry hacking fills our tent. It's the Khumbu cough, the sound of human lungs withering above 26,000 feet. He props himself up on an elbow and pulls his oxygen mask down. His voice is an inaudible rasp. Make out what he's saying, so I give him a thumbs up and motion for him to put his mask back on. He gives me a dull-eyed nod and burrows back into his Gore-Tex sleeping bag. Leah's sleeping bag is unfurled between us, empty. Neither one of us has the heart to put it away. A wave of nausea sweeps over me, and I curl to the side like an infant. The rim of my mask digs painfully into my cheek. I choke down ragged gasps from my oxygen bottle. Everything is so terribly cold. The nylon wall separates. I jerk upright. Wind rips in, raking icy daggers across my exposed face. A heavily bundled figure leans in through the hole, and I realize that Trip has let himself in through the door flap. The burly expedition leader tumbles into our tent, zipping the door closed behind him. His face is grave,
Doctor.
I reach for my pack. Is it Leah? Did they find her? Tripp's expression fills with sorrow. He shakes his head. An incredible ache fills my chest as the fading embers of hope blink out. My lip trembles.
Sorry.
Tripp runs a gloved hand over his beard before continuing.
It's Tashi. He's sick.
He points to his chest, then mimics a cough. I nod and follow him into the night. I kick my crampons into the ice as I step outside the tent. The metal teeth bite into the mountain as I pause before committing my full weight. My stiff muscles scream in protest as I lean into the window and follow Tripp's headlamp. Kick, pause, step. Kick, pause, step. The peak of Mount Everest looms above us to the north, obscured by the darkening sky. Leah's still up there. I look away. We pick our way around the desolate perimeter of Camp 4. Several clusters of bright yellow tents are pitched across the staging area, all shrugging helplessly under the barrage of wind. Each tent is illuminated from the inside by a lantern, giving a hauntingly subdued glow. Another gust tears through camp and billows the snow into a hazy mist. The snow obscures all but the nearest tents, which shudder like candle flames in the grim light. I notice the beam of Tripp's headlamp drawing ahead of me as I stumble forward to catch up. Kick, pause, step. Kick, pause, step. It's easy to get lost in these conditions. Mountaineers have lost sight of the tents, only to curl up and die in the lonely cold mere feet away from safety. We skirted several of their bodies while setting up camp. I take a ragged breath and push myself forward. The wind shrieks suddenly and I lose my footing. I stagger backwards, teeter, then fall to my side. I slide several feet, crashing painfully into an icy outcropping. I curl around the side of the frozen ledge, gripping it with both hands as I squeeze my eyes shut and take several long, slow breaths. In. Out. In. Out. Silent night. Holy night. I've been an emergency medicine doctor for 10 years. I thrive in chaos. I do not panic. I know the first rule of an emergency is to check your own pulse. I hum to myself, slow and soft, until my heart rate slows to meet the melody of the song. All is calm. All is bright. I open my eyes. A strangled scream rips itself from my throat. I'm staring into a frozen, leathery face. The eyes are wide and glaring. The gaping jaw hangs from sunken cheeks in a permanent expression of surprise. I am locked in a full-body embrace with one of Everest's many bodies. Revulsion spools in the back of my throat. A metallic, bitter taste fills my mouth. Cling to her for purchase as my feet scramble against icy rock. I begin to hyperventilate. The metered air from my oxygen bottle is too thin. I can't get enough air. I'm going to suffocate. I start to hum again, desperate to contain my terror. Round yon virgin mother and child. Slowly, my breath begins to stabilize. Shame twists my chest. This body isn't a horror. A human with a beating heart and wild, impossible dreams. No I wonder what happened to her. Did her teammates leave her out here to die? I pull myself to my knees, gripping her outstretched hand for support. The beam of Tripp's headlamp swings across me as he makes his way over in measured, precise steps. Thank you for catching me. I whisper to the dead mountaineer. Her head turns towards me, just a fraction of an inch. I gasp, trying to back away as her hand tightens on my own. Something grabs me from behind and I buck violently against the form at my back. I wrench my hand away from the corpse and throw myself into Tripp's arms.
Easy, it's just a body. They're all over out here.
I sob into his shoulder, the sound thankfully muffled by my oxygen mask. She moved. I wanted to shout. She grabbed me. With effort, I swallowed the words back into myself. I'm a doctor, and Tasha needs me right now. There's one person on this mountain that I can help, and I'm not going to let him down too. Tripp looks at the gauge on my oxygen bottle and shakes his head. He pulls another bottle out of his pack and replaces the canister.
Empty. Low oxygen makes you confused. That's when mistakes happen.
I nod, chagrined. Of course, a corpse didn't just try to drag me down the mountain. I was low on oxygen, exhausted, and borderline delirious. I take another deep breath and feel my head start to clear. Tripp is right. No mistakes. I look back once as we shuffle away, my headlamp glinting off a pair of frozen eyes. Her gaze is locked on me, the sagging jaw now twisted into a cruel sneer. When I turn away to follow Tripp, my back feels utterly exposed. A whisper of ice articulates down every facet of my spine. I shudder, trying not to imagine her leathery corpse bounding through the empty night behind me. When we reach the Sherpa's tent, Pemba and Dote are huddled over Tashi's sleeping bag. Dote is visibly flustered, fiddling with the straps of Tashi's oxygen mask. Pemba's weathered face is etched with concern. His piercing blue eyes meet my own as he slides away from Tashi's side. Pemba is worried. The realization fills me with unease. I grab a stethoscope from the medical kit and make my way over to Tashi. Tashi is difficult to rouse. His eyes flutter. He responds to my questions with incoherent mumbles. His cough reverberates through the tent. When I listen to his chest, his breath draws in with an ominous wet crackle. What happened? My confusion is obvious. Tashi is by far the strongest climber on the team.
He was leading the search party. He went back up to the south summit today. Pushed himself too hard.
A lump forms in my throat. I swallow it down. I see. Well, it's high-altitude pulmonary edema. I can give him some nifedipine, but we need to get him down right away. No one seems surprised by my diagnosis. They're all intimately familiar with altitude sickness. Dote looks up. Says he'll take Tashi down the mountain. His lip trembles as he speaks. In this moment, he looks so incredibly young. I think of all the times I've watched Dote following Tashi around, his little brother worship of the more experienced climber. Tripp and Pemba confer in hushed voices. Finally, Tripp nods.
Suicide to try to descend in the dark. So Alex and Dote will take him down first thing in the morning. Pemba and I can guide the rest of the group down behind you guys.
Dote bites his lip in frustration, his eyes glistening with concern. Eventually, he shakes his head in agreement. My heart sinks. Takahashi in this condition, there won't be another search party. My mind flashes back to the summit, to my last glimpse of Leah's face, her visible exhaustion, her unrestrained joy. The climbing partner I came to love like a sister. What were our last words to each other? Your daughter will be so proud. I told her as I wrapped her in a bear hug.
I couldn't have done it without you.
Her words echo in my memory, punching me low in the gut. Would she have turned back in time if I hadn't been pushing her along? What signs of deterioration did I overlook? I should have been watching more carefully. I should have noticed when she unclipped from the guideline and wandered off into the snow. Now, there is no one left to search for her. I'm too weak to get back up the mountain, let alone help another climber down. Toshi is the strongest of us. When he fell ill, Leah's timer ran out. All of this for nothing. I'm shocked at the callousness of my own thoughts. Toshi breaks into another hacking cough. I silently chastise myself as I reposition his oxygen mask. I'll stay for a while and keep an eye on him.
Good. Thank you. I better go update the team.
Toshi's condition stabilizes over the next several hours. He even manages to crack a joke about helping Dote down the mountain, but it does little to relieve the tension. We all know how tenuous his improvement is. His cough is still wet and racking. His effort at humor is belied by deep sadness welling in his dark brown eyes. None of us are safe yet. I need to check on Mick. So I give Dote some instructions and step out of the tent. I scuff my crampons into the ice and visualize the route back to my tent. I'll have to pass the dead mountaineer. My chest tightens as I imagined her outstretched arm, her hungry sneer. I shake my head. I'm being ridiculous. I don't believe in the supernatural. I believe in the cognitive implications of dehydration and hypoxia. I repeat this, trying to assert logic over skittish unease, but the effort falls short. My spine prickles. Even through my Alti expedition mittens, my right hand is chilled to the bone. The hand she grabbed. I shudder and head into the night. My dread mounts as I approach the patch of rock where I slid into the dead mountaineer. A dull ache throbs between my temples. My head feels light, and the back of my neck itches terribly. I plod forward, forcing myself to look as I pass. There's no body in sight. The patch of rock is barren, the empty snow undisturbed. Impossible. My breath is thready. I whirl, flinging the beam of my headlamp through the darkness. The light skitters across snow and ice. Wind howls through the empty camp. I am completely alone. Suddenly, I notice another light flickering in the distance. I pause to get my bearings. It's coming from the north. From what must be the lower edge of the slope leading up to the summit. The light is feeble, barely visible through the gusts of snow. I gasp. Leah! Hope flames in my chest. Miracles have happened on Mount Everest before. Climbers have survived the unthinkable, made their way back to camp against insurmountable odds. The stories are preciously rare, but Leah is going to be one of them. I debate for just a moment. The best course would be to grab some extra rope from my tent and drag a line out to be sure I won't get lost. But if I lose sight of Leah's headlamp while rummaging inside my tent, I might never find her again. She could misstep and fall off the side of the mountain in the time it takes for me to grab a line. Every second counts right now. I've left her once before. I'll never be able to live with myself if I fail her now. I start towards the flickering beam of Leah's headlamp. Instead of picking my feet up between steps, I drag them through the snow. This creates a trail of two deep furrows. I reason that I can follow this path back if the wind picks up enough to obscure the tents. As I trudge forward, I take stock of what I have at my disposal. I have an oxygen bottle attached to my mask and one spare bottle clipped to the right side of my belt. My Petzl ice axe is clipped to the left. Three carabiners and a 6-foot length of cord hang from the back. I have a Clif bar in my back pocket, but no water. I have one headlamp. The battery should have plenty of life remaining. I have no medical supplies, no radio. A whirl of snow briefly obscures the flickering light, and my breath catches in my throat. No. I halt. Desperation bubbles in my chest. I click off my own headlamp and strain to spot Leah. There. I swallow back a sob of relief. I'm getting closer. I'll need to take Leah to Tasha's tent first. That's where the medical kit is. I can send Dote to go find Trip. He'll need to radio base camp and prepare them to exfiltrate two injured climbers. I'll offer to help Leah down from Camp 4. She's going to be in bad shape, but if she's made it this far, she's at least ambulatory. Consider my flagging strength. Can I get her down? Or will I be more of a danger to us both in this condition? I grit my teeth. I can do this. We both come down together, or not at all. Leah's lamp is brighter now. Maybe a few hundred feet away. I need to keep going. Cold worms through the protective layers of my climbing gear, numbing my hands and feet. My nose and cheeks burn painfully. I rein in the vestiges of my strength. If I don't start moving right now, we'll both die. I click my headlamp back on. A scream erupts from my throat, shattering the frigid night. A withered form is hunched in the beam of my headlamp, glaring viciously up at me. Its teeth are bared in a crooked grimace. The torso is uncovered, revealing an expanse of blackened, frostbitten skin. I stagger backwards, fighting to keep my balance. If I fall here, I will slide to my death down the Lhotse face. The beam of my headlamp dances as I tremble violently. The figure twists its head, keeping its narrowed eyes trained on me. I gasp in horrified disbelief. It raises one sinewy arm and plants it in the snow, rocking its weight forwards towards me. I scrabble for the ice axe at my hip.
Get back!
The figure raises its other arm, bent inwards at a horrible angle, and continues to shuffle forward. I hear a wet, crunching sound as it draws near. I take a swing with my axe and miss. A hand shoots forward, grabbing my left ankle. I teeter, plant my right foot, and maintain my balance. It drags itself closer, jaws gnashing expectantly. I pivot, swinging from my hips as I bring my axe down again. The axe connects with the side of the figure's contorted face, shattering its temple. The hand around my ankle releases as shards of the thing's face splinter into the snow. It writhes, its one remaining eye wild with fury. I almost break and run back towards camp. I'm turning, getting ready to flee, when I catch sight of Leah's headlamp flickering in the dark. She's so close now. I can't let these things get her. I sidestep around the thrashing corpse and drive myself towards Leah. I can't manage a run, but I accelerate. Kick, pause, step. Kick, pause, step. Kick, pause, step. My lungs burn with the effort. My vision darkens, blurring past the edges of my headlamp. Terror propels me onward. Determination directs my course. I don't look back. Get to Leah. What the fuck is happening? Just get to Leah. I sob when Leah's hot pink jacket comes into view. I race up to her, wrapping her in a giant hug.
My God, Leah. I'm so sorry. I'm gonna get you back to camp, okay? You're all right now. It's going to be okay.
Leah sags into my embrace. I hold her for a moment, then step back to look her over. The valve of her oxygen bottle is encrusted with thick ice. She's lost a glove. Her black tipped fingers fade into a mottled gray. Fourth degree frostbite. She's going to lose most of her left hand.
Shit, Leah, sorry.
She stumbles toward me. Her pink jacket ripples in the wind. She's confused, delirious. I knew she'd be in bad condition, but damn. How is she even standing? I fumble for the carabiners and cord at my waist.
I'm gonna short rope you back, okay? I'll clip our belts together and lead you to Camp 4. It's not that far away. Can you make it 10 more minutes?
I can't hear her response through the ice-covered mask. I clip us together and turn to the south. There's my trail. It'll lead us straight back to camp. I don't mention the bodies. It'll only cause her to panic. She just needs to focus on getting back to the tents. My heart is thumping erratically as I start to lead her forward. I found her. I swivel my headlamp as we move through the night. I'm not going to be surprised by another body creeping through the dark. Tension coils in my gut. Leah lags behind me. Our pace is frighteningly slow. Keep moving. My legs stiffen, numbed by exhaustion and freezing wind. I feel my body teetering at the precipice of human endurance, threatening to collapse. Keep moving. I will not let Leah die. I think of her words on the summit. I couldn't have done it without you. There is hope in those words now. An expectation unbarred. A promise I can still live up to. I force myself onward, sucking at the dregs of my supplemental oxygen. We both come down together or not at all. We come to a patch of disturbed snow. My pulse pounds, anticipation clawing up at my throat. I swing my headlamp in wild arcs, but the corpse is gone. For now. I see a cluster of dull yellow lights ahead. Camp 4. We're so close now. Leah staggers behind me. I gently tug her forward. I start humming, hoping to distract her as we close the gap to our tents. Silent night, holy night. I feel her start to move behind me. This is it. The home stretch. I drag one foot up, then the other. My universe narrows to the very next step. Then the next. We are going to make it. All is calm. All is bright. I swivel my gaze to the right. Something is crouching in the snow. Please let that be a rock formation. It shifts. Dread washes down my spine. I scan to the left. Two more figures lurk in the distance. I look ahead. Something skitters out of the corner of my headlamp beam. I keep humming, low and soft. I pray that Leah hasn't noticed them. I slowly pull my ice axe out of my belt loop. I swing my lamp from side to side. Bent forms prowl around us. They shuffle forward with slow, ungainly steps. Terror seizes my chest as they close around us. Frozen, Vicious eyes. Contorted postures. Tattered, frozen flesh. I guess prayer. I raise my axe as they circle, bracing myself for attack. What are they waiting for? Leah stutters to a halt behind me. Come on, Leah, not now. I step backwards towards her, still shifting my gaze, trying to keep all of the looming creatures in sight.
Hey, Leah, sweetie. We're so close to camp. We're so, so close. But I need you to move right now. Okay?
She doesn't respond. She reaches out for me with her gnarled, frostbitten hand.
Come on, Leah. You can do this. I'm going to keep you safe, but you need to start moving right now.
She reaches for my ice axe. With a sudden burst, she grabs it away from me and throws me into the darkness.
Leah, what the hell?
Leah clumsily tugs at her own oxygen mask. I stare, paralyzed by a sudden sinking feeling deep in my chest. She finally manages to pull the mask away, ripping her snow goggles and headlamp off in the process. Dread blooms, consuming me in a full-body shudder. Leah's face is laced with ice. Patches of graying frostbite line her nose and cheeks. Her mouth hangs open, jaw cocked at a strange angle. She does not blink. She does not move. She does not breathe. I'm sobbing now, shaking my head in disbelief.
Leah, no. No, no, please, no.
Her claw-like hand grabs the cord connecting us. She takes a step towards me.
I came to save you. It was all gonna be all right.
Shadows circle in the periphery of my vision. The noose of corpses tightens around us. Leah steps up to my chest. We are eye to frozen eye.
Leah, no.
She lurches forward, knocking me to the ground. I scrabble back. A strong hand grabs me by the ankle. I kick, but her grip holds firm.
Leah!
She's dragging herself forward, inching up over my body. I hear the wet crackle of her movements. Figures loom behind her with icy, petrified grins. She reaches up and rips the oxygen mask from my face. Sub-zero wind burrows into my lungs. My mind goes hazy. The air flies out of my lungs as she drags herself up my chest. Sleep heavenly peace. Her frozen jaws sink into my cheek. Sleep heavenly peace.
Ollie A. White, Kristen Samito,
and Marcus Demanda. I'm your host and executive producer, David Cummings. To discover how you can get even more sleepless horror stories from us, just visit sleepless.thenosleeppodcast.com to learn about the Sleepless Universe, ad-free extended episodes each week, and lots of bonus content for the dark hours, all for one low monthly price. On behalf of everyone at the No Sleep Podcast, we thank you for listening closely and embracing the sound. This audio program is copyright 2026 by Creative Reason Media. The copyrights for each story are held by the respective authors. No duplication or reproduction of this audio program is permitted without the written consent of Creative Reason Media. No part of this audio program may be used or reproduced in any manner for the purpose of training artificial intelligence technologies or systems. All rights reserved.